Now, Stigma of Mental Illness Radio on CosmicBroadcasting.com and the Cosmic Broadcasting app.
I remember when I lost my mind. There was something so pleasant about that place.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining me today. My name is Chrissy Hodges, and you're listening to the Stigma of Mental Illness Radio here at CosmicBroadcasting.com. Before we jump into the topic of the week, I want to share a few thoughts with you that are related to what we're going to be talking about today. First of all, I think it is not ironic, but it's definitely a good thing that right now is kind of Veterans Day, Veterans Week here in the U.S. And I don't know if that's all over, but I think it's very fitting that we are going to talk about some things related to the military this week. And I didn't even plan that. I always love it when that happens. But first, before we get to that, I just want to share a few thoughts. I wrote a blog post a few weeks ago, and the actual title, I don't know. I think it was called Stop Apologizing for Your Mental Illness. And I received a comment toward that I really didn't think about at the time. And then when I read my guest's book, who she will be talking to us a little bit later, I started thinking about the blog post and the comment that I got. The topic of the blog was that when we suffer with a mental illness, one of the things that I had to come to terms with, especially dealing with personal stigma, was to not apologize for having the mental illness. I always felt like I had to tell people how sorry I was and how sorry I am for my bizarre behavior, my bizarre thought patterns, and in general, it was a way of trying to come to terms with it for myself. I was so embarrassed and so ashamed that I was deemed mentally ill, or am deemed mentally ill, that it always felt like it was a hindrance to everyone else, and at times it can be. My behavior is definitely not fun to deal with, and with my loved ones and support system, sometimes I know that they wish I didn't have the disorder. However, I received a comment from someone, and at the time I was a little irritated at the comment. You know, negative comments are never fun. But she talked about how she didn't really quite understand the blog and hope that I meant what I said I meant, which at the bottom, of course, I put the disclaimer that none of us ever have the right to treat people bad and use our mental illness as an excuse. But I don't think she wanted to read the disclaimer, and wrote something along the lines of, my father has a mental illness and we have suffered for it, and he flat out refuses to apologize for all the things that he's done. So I started thinking about that. And I wrote back to her, and I don't know what I wrote. Definitely was diplomatic about it. But I started thinking about that as I was reading Catherine Fox's book, Stolen Memories. And it's about combat PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And yes, I think that it made me understand the comment more, but also to just reemphasize that I don't feel like it's ever okay to treat people badly because of your mental illness, or make other people hurt. However, I did want to stress the point that there have been times in my life in working through the personal stigma of having a mental illness where I don't even know the damage that I'm doing because my brain has taken over and my brain skews the way that I view the world. And sometimes you don't know what you're doing to people or how you make people feel. And I've mentioned this before. I've lost friends because of my mental illness. So I look back and feel regret, sure, but at the same time, I kind of feel, when I did come to terms with what was going on and I was able to have a conversation rationally to create an apology for hurting people, and they didn't want to continue the friendship, I consider that to be a good loss, I guess. But I think that there are two ways to look at it, and there's a fine line, and I think I'm kind of struggling on how to feel about it. And I'm hoping that in my conversation today with my guest, I can come away with it feeling a little bit better about my point of view there. However, I am always glad to be challenged on how I believe based on somebody else's experience, because it's obviously a way that I haven't been able to look at it. It's definitely a different feeling when you're dealing with the individual who has a mental illness and a loved one. And that's what we're going to explore today. on my show. My guest is she is calling in today from from England. I'm always excited to have people from other countries. A, because it just feels so global, and B, I love hearing the different accents. And so I'm going to do a quick introduction of her, and then she is going to talk a little bit about her story and her book and some related points to post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm interviewing Catherine Fox, who lives in Sheffield, England. She is the ex-wife of a serving British soldier. She has written and self-published her story in her book, Stolen Memories, and she tells of how post-traumatic stress disorder affected her ex-husband and ultimately the trauma it inflicted on her and her children. Combat PTSD is a global issue, and as a result, many loved ones are suffering because of the stigma that surrounds it and the code of silence that exists within the military. For this reason, she also runs a Facebook support group for wives, girlfriends who have suffered abuse at the hands of the military PTSD partners. She has over 230 ladies in the group from around the world. Just a side note, and Catherine wanted me to mention this, and I think it's definitely a good point. PTSD is not only related to the military, and I know that that can be confused, but it can also be a result of any sort of traumatic episode or event that someone has experienced. So welcome to the show, Catherine.
Hi, Chrissy.
Thank you so much for being here. And I wrote you yesterday, and I just wanted to say again how much I am thoroughly enjoying your book. I have just become engrossed in it, and my apologies for not being able to finish it before the interview, but I will quickly be doing that in the next couple days.
Oh, thank you.
I would love for you to get started with this interview, just kind of telling us the base of what you've been through, if you just want to do a quick overview of what your story is and how things transpired into the way that they are right now.
Okay. Well, I met my, well, now ex-husband on New Year's Eve 2000. And I think it was around 10 to 12, you know, the time when you're looking for the guy that you're going to have your New Year's Eve kiss with. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, you know, just spotted somebody that I was going to kind of go for. But then all of a sudden, this sort of young lad put himself in the way. And it kind of went from there, and he was a bit persistent. And I wasn't particularly interested until he happened to mention that he was in the army, which I've always had a thing for, you know, men in uniform and the protective nature of them, you know, and the hero side of it. So we carried on talking that night, and then we met up again the next day. And I wouldn't say it was love at first sight, but certainly the next day I just completely fell head over heels in love with this man. And literally on the second day he told me himself that he was in love with me, and I was much older than him, but I just had to go with it. It was just, I've never ever felt like that before in my life. Within a week he asked me to marry him. We got the wedding booked for 9 months later. 6 months later, I was already pregnant. We got married within, 9 months we got married, and within 14 months we'd had our first child together. And we were just so, it was just perfect. It was just like Prince Charming to me. It was just a fairy tale, and I would just describe it to people as just being absolutely perfect. Mm-hmm. So we had our daughter first, and then went on to have our second child, a son. And again, it just couldn't be better. Life just didn't get any better than it was. I wasn't a military wife who lived on camp with him, so we only really saw each other at weekends and holidays and things. So the time we spent together was just so precious, and he just couldn't wait to be home with us. He just absolutely lived to get home to us. He loved the military. It was really was a soldier through and through. But the time we spent together was just, it was just amazing. It was just the best thing that ever happened to me. We managed to avoid many deployments. He did a 6-week tour of Iraq, but that was fine. We got through that one. And then in October 2009 was when he went for his first tour of Afghanistan. And the build-up to that was just the worst thing. Our daughter at the time was 7 years old, and she knew what was good. She knew what could happen out there, so she was so scared. And waving goodbye to him on the platform was just the most heartbreaking thing, to see her just not wanting to let him go and sort of jumping on the train after him. But 3 months later, he came back for leave. He had his first leave from there. And again, meeting him on the train station, was it was just like a Hollywood movie, that when he got off there and he was this 6'4" man in uniform, and she saw him, and she ran down the platform, and everybody parted, and she just threw herself at him, and he knelt down and up. I swear it was just Hollywood. It was true Hollywood. But I think in hindsight, looking back now, as I talk more about my story, I would honestly say that's probably the last time that we truly saw the man that we loved. And I think when he did finally come back 3 months after that, I think in hindsight now, as soon as he walked into that gym, he was just different. He just wasn't the same. He wasn't the same person. And then what followed after that really was kind of just downhill, and just 18 months then of progressive strange behaviour, abuse, and just, it was just totally destroyed. This absolute fairy tale was just totally destroyed within 18 months.
Catherine, did you have any idea what was going on with him when he came back? Did you try to talk to him? And in your mind, did PTSD ever even cross your mind?
Do you know, it didn't, and it should have, because I knew full well about PTSD, but it never entered my mind until I got to the point where I just had enough of his behaviour. And it was only when he broke down and then started telling me the things that he'd been experiencing, and hallucinations and voices, and I didn't know what was going off in his head, and I didn't know him anymore. But certainly in hindsight now, looking back, that those 2 weeks when he was actually on leave, there was an instant there where it was very clear that, you know, it was starting. Because he was having nightmares, and he would wake up in the night shouting at someone to get away from her, and he would pull me close to him, and he would be like staring at things that just weren't there. And I know now that he was having hallucinations.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about PTSD. From, you've had the firsthand experience. Now, I think a lot of my listeners, and I'm going to be honest with you, I thought that I knew what PTSD was until I read in your book some of the symptoms, yeah. and then the reaction. So, if you could just tell us what it is, and what really causes it. Oh, you know, we could think, oh, whatever, I had a car wreck, and now, you know, I have a few nightmares of having a wreck or something, but that's not necessarily it. Tell us a little more in depth.
Well, certainly, I mean, as you alluded to, it generally is, you know, you've been in a traumatic event, or you've witnessed it, or it was life-threatening. So, yeah, it can be from car crashes. The most commonly known is combat PTSD. So what happens with them is, obviously, we can't even begin to imagine what they see out there. Things that is just, you know, my husband saw a young suicide bomber blow up in front of his face. Mm-hmm. You just cannot even begin to imagine what that would be like. So when he came back, he would have flashbacks, and he would see that in his head. But what he wouldn't see that boy, he would see our son. So when he would then look at our son, he would literally see our son explode in front of his face.
Okay.
So obviously, I didn't know all of this at the time. So the way those symptoms were appearing with him is, where he would used to come home and he'd be, you know, out with the kids, he'd be playing football, and it was just quality time we had together. He would just push them away, and he didn't want to be around our son. And he wouldn't play with him, he wouldn't look at him, he wouldn't do anything with him. And it wasn't until the end that was why he was doing that. So we just thought he was just being miserable and grumpy, but actually he just couldn't bear to look at him.
Wow. And did he know what was going on?
He knew what was going on, but because there's such they don't want to talk about it, they don't want to own up to this. So he knew what was going on, but he just never said. So I think it's kind of like they prefer to be thought of as a bad dad or a bad husband now, rather than actually face up and own up to the fact that they need help.
Really?
Certainly in the UK, it's definitely, as much as the media and the government and the military will say it's not, it's definitely felt that it's a form of weakness to own up. there was no way my husband was going to own up.
Tell me about the guilt that comes along with PTSD, and does the guilt have anything to do with, does it exacerbate what's going on with the symptoms?
It does. I mean, again, certainly when they're out in Afghanistan, and when you know when you're the one that's giving out the orders, and you've given an order to somebody to take a particular route, or you know, do a particular thing. If then, because again, there was an instant where my husband told one of his guys to follow a particular route, and as he said that, the guy took a few steps and was killed by an IED. Well, he totally blames himself for that. Completely blames himself for that, and it was his fault that his friend got killed. And part of that guilt was then that he would think he doesn't then deserve to come back to this wonderful life that he had, this perfect family that he had. He doesn't deserve it. He doesn't deserve to have us. So part of that then is that they then start to push you away.
How does that make you feel?
See, at the time, it's so confusing. And certainly for me, because 18 months, to be honest, is probably quite a quick time to have been destroyed so quickly. But at the time, because he's not been back long, you just think, well, he's just readjusted. You understand. You understand why he's being grumpy and he's maybe not wanting to play with the kids. But eventually you just think, he doesn't love me anymore. That's all it can be. This man who just worshipped me before, all of a sudden seems to hate me. He doesn't want anything to do with me. He barely looks at me. He barely talks to me. He makes excuses not to come home. He's suspicious with his phone. And you just obviously think all sorts. And you just think, this is all the hallmarks of someone having an affair here. Mm-hmm. But it's not that. He's just pushing you away. He just doesn't feel like he deserves you.
So whether or not you know, or whether or not you do, or you don't know whether it's PTSD, it still had to take a toll on you and your self-esteem and how you viewed yourself in the world.
It does. I mean, I've always been a real sort of strong-minded, independent, feisty woman. And I think it's probably only when I got my head back and got my head clear that I could look back on how I'd been those 18 months and just realising that I used to go into work every Monday, and I'd used to spend about the first hour just saying what a miserable weekend I'd had and with all the things he'd done. But then by the end of it, I'd be justifying it and like you would say, I'd make excuses for him. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I just thought, I was literally doing this every single weekend. And I was just, you know, I'm one of those people that doesn't get, I just let things wash over me, I just think whatever. But the simplest of things would just have me in tears, and I would just be snappy at work, and I was just never ever like that. I was just, nothing ever necessarily got to me. If there's something I couldn't do anything about, it didn't bother me, but I was just so snappy, and I was starting to get so withdrawn, and I just was totally not myself. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you just think, whatever, you know, this man just doesn't love me anymore.
And if he's treating the family like this, and granted, you've given the description of what was really going on in his head, even though you didn't know at the time, how was he acting toward his colleagues or his fellow soldiers? Did they notice anything different, or did anyone outside the immediate family get treated the way that you were getting treated?
Well, when I think. There must have been signs when he was actually still in Afghanistan, because he did, when he came back, he actually was put under investigation for three incidents that happened out there. And one of the things that he said was that his colleagues didn't want to work with him. They didn't want to work with him anymore, and they were making up lies about him. And it was kind of like he was paranoid that everybody was out to get him, and you know, he was the only one that was doing things right, and they were making up all of these stories. But again, it's so hard to get any information from the military that even though he was under this investigation, I still to this day have no clue what the truth was about that, because I was hearing it from him. And all I was getting was, you know, he was the one in the right. It was the whole of his regiment that was wrong, basically. So I'm sure they knew. I'm absolutely positive that they knew that something was wrong. But because I never lived on camp with him, I didn't really, I had no one to talk to. I couldn't ask any of his colleagues because I didn't really know them. So again, it was always secondhand information that I was getting from him, and I'm sure that he was experienced. I'm sure that his colleagues knew. I mean, he was an infantry soldier, and he was moved from that posting into another regiment. So they knew something, but they just never told me.
Is the Army not prepared for these type of responses? Or do they? I don't want to say do they not just care, not care, but. Do they understand that this is a real disorder and this really happens? And what are they doing to rectify this?
I think if you believe the press and you believe the hype, they'll say absolutely they do and they've got it all under control, and they'll throw out all the good stories and all the positive stories and all the success stories and how these guys have all, you know, they have spoken up and PTSD is treatable and look at all these families that are being successful. But that's great if they'll speak up, but there's just so many of them that don't. And when I was going through this with him, when he did open up and he did tell us, and he had a breakdown in front of myself and the children, and I rang the Army up, told them everything that he told me, and they said, yeah, he clearly has got combat stress, but we can't do anything until he says so.
Really?
I just thought, well, you know, I've had to go through this for him to open up to me, and I had to literally try and blackmail him to them. So he did ring them up, and he just told them he was perfectly fine, that I was just making it all up, that we'd just broken up, and that I was just making all these lies up about him.
Oh my goodness.
And they preferred to believe that, really.
That seems pretty contradictory. That, oh, he must, yes, it exactly sounds like this is what he's suffering with, but, oh, by the way, we can't do anything unless he says something.
Yeah.
That seems extremely contradictory.
I've heard that so many times before, and I've seen programs on telly where families have just been crying out saying, he's not right. I'm telling you, he is not right. And they're just saying, what do you want me to do? What do you want me to do? He won't say anything. If he doesn't say anything, what can we do? And I suppose that's one of the issues with mental health in general, isn't it? If you don't, unless you want the help and you'll accept it, there's not much that anyone can do, really.
Well, but wouldn't it seem like it would be their responsibility, since he is kind of officially an employee?
Yeah, you definitely think so. I mean, nobody knows them better than their loved ones. I mean, even their blood family. I mean, you were saying, you know, his employers and his family. His family preferred to believe that he just didn't love me anymore and just didn't want to be with me, and that I just wouldn't accept that. But that didn't explain why all of a sudden he didn't want to be around his kids either. And they just would not accept what I was telling them. And I can understand that, because it's hard to accept that your child is ill and it's going through all of this.
Does stigma play a role in that?
Definitely. I mean, like I say, certainly in the UK military, the stigma of admitting to PTSD is that you're weak. You should man up. You shouldn't be having this. It's just, you know, man up and get on with the job, basically.
I can't speak for the military here in America, but I don't think that it's probably that much different. I think in general, it's, you know, it, just across the board, especially dealing with men. No offense to all the men listening out there, but I think with men, it definitely becomes more of a pride issue and they're conditioned to not ask for help because it conveys some sort of weakness.
Yeah. I think being a man just adds to the problem.
Tell me about the symptoms of PTSD. And I obviously have read about them in the book, but I didn't realize how extreme they were for the individual, as well as how much they affect others who are experiencing the secondary PTSD. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing with thing with PTSD is that because they have experienced these traumatic events, they'll block it out because they don't want to revisit it. So they block that out in their heads. The problem is that if they put themselves in this emotionless bubble, so not only do they try to block out the guilt and the hurt, they block out love and affection, and they block out all of that, which is why all of a sudden the families just seem to be pushed to the side. So I tended to, and afterwards, but I tended to block things out myself then, because I'd had 10 wonderful years with this man. This man was the love of my life. We just had a absolutely perfect life. And then when all of a sudden he became who he did, I just thought, that's fake. That can't have been true. He actually must have been this horrible, you know, monster all along. He must have not been that person. And I kind of blocked out those 10 years and thought, well, they're just not true. That was just, that life was just a complete fake. So I kind of blocked it out, and I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to think about the good times, because to me then that was a trigger for me.
Uh-huh.
Their triggers, then I had my own triggers, and I blocked that out, and I didn't want to talk about it. But I had to, and the only way for me to get through that was writing the book, because the hardest bit for me to write about was the good times. The hard times were quite easy in a way, because you're kind of comforted by the anger that you then have towards them.
Uh-huh.
So the hard thing is really to revisit the good times, because it just reminds you of what you've lost. So through writing the book, I managed to revisit all of that, and I managed to face up to that and shed a lot of tears on that. But I can now look back on those 10 years though and think, do you know what, they were my memories, and I'm, you know, I'm keeping them, and I'm going to keep revisiting those ones. So that was a kind of way in how it was secondary PTSD in myself. But uh-huh. One of the things, my daughter, she was old enough to realise that, you know, she all of a sudden wasn't daddy's girl anymore, and he just was rejecting her, basically. So she had a lot of anger issues herself. She got very angry with myself and her little brother. She would take a lot of things out on him, forever falling out at school, very emotional. I would hear her cry at night. I would hear her in a room just crying. And she had to have a little bit of counselling from the school. And it was just because her dad had rejected her so much, it was just, uh-huh. Again, she was getting the little petty fallouts with children at school were just so magnified for her. They were her trigger then. So she suffered.
Right. And your son as well.
My son is, it was to you because he was a bit younger. I wouldn't say he's, I don't think he quite understood, in all honesty, at the time. Mm-hmm. Probably the sad thing with my son is that whilst my daughter does have good memories of her dad, my son doesn't, because he was at that age, all he remembers was the bad things that he did.
Right. Well, this is a great interview to point out how much others are affected by mental illness, and a lot of my show is focused on the individuals that are suffering with mental illness. So this is why I love having people like you, Catherine, on, and just can talk about how you suffer just as much, mm-hmm. as your loved one. And I, interestingly enough, I was looking through Facebook today, and a Facebook page came up, and there was a little meme, and it's asking, what are some of the symptoms that you struggle with secondary PTSD? And it's, this page is for wives. And yeah. I mean, all the way down, it is the same. Did you see that today?
Yes, I did. I don't know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, and I actually posted on there too, for people to listen to the interview. But it's all the same: anxiety, depression, sleep, headache, loneliness, feeling alone, worried about violence, things like that. And I read it, and it just stopped me in my tracks. And just to think about how much you suffer just as much. Now, it's been a while, obviously, since this the relationship has ended. What's it like for you now?
I think it's still with me every single day. I'm sure, I think he pops into my head as soon as I wake up in the morning, and probably the last thing at night. But I know I just feel like it no longer kind of rips out my heart anymore, and that it sometimes feels like it kind of bubbles up and it wants to come out and it wants to, you know, I want to break, but I just don't, and I'm strong enough to be able to stop that now. I just feel an overwhelming sadness that, to be honest, that this happened, and not only for myself and obviously my two children, but for him, because he has to now live with this forever.
Uh-huh.
And he can go on and he can remarry and he can have other children, but he's never going to replace what happened. And I think the post you were talking about today, you'll see a lot of women say anger. There is, uh-huh, a lot of anger. I have a lot of anger towards my husband, but not anger at him for being ill. He never asked for this. He went and did his job and this happened. My anger at him is simply because he didn't fight it. It can be treated. And for all that feistiness and strength that I have in trying to help other women now, that was all there for him. That was all there to support him. So that's my anger towards him. But I feel so sorry for him, because as much as I paid a heavy price for this, he paid more as far as I'm concerned, because he pushed away his children. He doesn't see his children. He hasn't seen them for 2 years. He hasn't spoken to them for 2 years.
Oh, wow. Now, addressing that, and I did read, I don't want to give too much away in the book, because I definitely want people to get it and read it, but in the book, and you mentioned earlier, before he left, he did tell you everything that was going on in his head, and I think that's maybe when the light came on for you of, yeah, oh, this, yeah, is what's happening.
Yeah.
Now, if he willingly admits all this, is he just not accepting that that's what the responsibility of it, and then just decides he does not want to get help? And if so, why not?
Again, I think it totally comes back to the stigma. And again, he had seen friends who had owned up to it, and they'd been discharged. They'd been medically discharged. But when all you've ever known is to be in the military, and that's all you've ever wanted to be, it was so frightening for him to run the risk of losing that. And again, because he was feeling guilty, being with us again wasn't. I think that sometimes it's kind of his own punishment. He was punishing himself for what he did out there, what he saw. So he was trying to punish himself by pushing us away, and he wasn't going to run up to it. He wasn't going to deal with it. He was just going to take the punishment, basically.
Is it standard protocol for people to be discharged if they experience PTSD? I'm scared to hear the answer.
I think you probably know the answer. They'll do it in a good way, but they won't stay in. They certainly don't stay in. But in a way, I can also kind of understand that, because it's not the kind of illness that then you want to go put in a gun in someone's hand who's having all these issues. But the flip side of that is the fact that they ignored me is exactly what they are doing.
This is really frustrating for me to hear this, and I'm not even in it, but I cannot imagine what you and so many wives and families are going through.
You just don't hear it. I mean, I know we'll talk about that. You mentioned the support group that I set up. I get so frustrated on that page, because of the 235 ladies that are there are 5 UK ladies. And the rest are mainly from the USA.
Just because they don't want to talk, no one wants to talk about it?
No, nope, don't want to talk about it. Don't want to run up to it.
Is it what's different in the UK?
I don't know if it's. I mean, obviously, there's ladies from the US on there who are more open, but because it's a safe environment for them to talk. Mm-hmm. I think the difference that I see here is that in the UK, our men just don't own up to it, basically. Whereas in the US, it seems like they own up to it, but then the wives then still suffer because the men are kind of felt sorry for, and because they've already been broken, the courts would be lenient on them, and will understand maybe why they will be abusive, and it's kind of, they get the sympathy for that, and it's kind of excused and brushed under the carpet, and then that's, I think, how the US ladies are suffering. Whereas in the UK, it's just again back to this code of silence that's around it.
What's happening? Is there anything happening or anything on the forefront that's going to change this?
Not that I can see. I mean, obviously, I'm so trying to raise awareness. But when I wrote my book, I emailed all the media outlets in the UK. I contacted the government, all the magazines, all the newspapers. Not one of them was interested. I contacted all the well-known charities in the UK, and I'll not name them, but there's probably three that are very well-known. One specifically was just made for PTSD, basically. I contacted them all, and I told them my story, and said, I've written this book, and, you know, I know it's hard to read, but it's kind of like tough love. I want people to read this and see that this is the reality. PTSD is not hearts and flowers. It's not stand by your man. This is the reality of it, and there is a dark side to this and a heartbreaking side to it. And I thought, I want somebody to read it and to know that this is the reality and that they might go and get some help. And the answer I got back from these charities was, we only focus on success stories.
Oh, okay. So everybody else should just be left out to suffer.
Absolutely. Yeah, when you've got a guy on Speak Up and he's getting treatment and his wife's there by his side and she's supporting him and she's getting treatment herself and they're getting through the day-to-day stuff and still, whilst it's not nice and it's, you know, it's still heartbreaking what they're going through, but because he's spoken up and because they're getting this treatment, that's successful. Because my husband didn't, because we had to put up with abuse, because in the end I had to leave him, that's not a success.
But this your book probably represents a high percentage of people.
I'm sure it does, because the only thing that they have is the ones who speak up. What about all those that don't?
So your book is primarily a source for those who have to suffer in silence.
Pretty much.
Wow. Do they just believe that PTSD doesn't technically exist? Because I've heard this before, and so I'm just wondering if do people just believe it's made up or that it's a real illness?
No, I think they believe it exists, absolutely. But I think the perception of PTSD is just that it's flashbacks, it's having nightmares, it's being maybe a little bit miserable. It's not seeing your child explode in front of your face. It's not, you know, he was hallucinating in his car, and on one particular occasion he left my daughter on the motorway and drove off because he was hallucinating his car, and he thought he was protecting her because he was trying to get away from these hallucinations, but he left her on the motorway. I mean, thankfully he came to his senses a little bit away, and she just thought he was playing games with her. But that is just so horrendous and so dangerous. When I found out he'd done that, it was just heartbreaking, because the consequences if he'd not come to his senses just don't even bear thinking about. But that is such a dark thought that they don't want to see that. They want to see that they're having flashbacks and we're counselling them, and that's all nice and pretty, and that's, I think, what their perception of PTSD is.
Did you have any backlash from the book, Catherine?
I'm not from the book, but when I went through it, I had just no one to talk to, which is part of the reason I wrote the book and wanted people to really understand it. So I did start joining groups, and another one you mentioned earlier, there were a lot of groups that I joined that were for wives and girlfriends, but it was very much the stand by your man, the hearts and flowers, the he's a hero, he didn't ask for this, I will never leave him. So of course when I go on and said, well, actually, you know, sometimes it's not giving up, you're just letting go, because to me he wasn't the man I loved, that man didn't come back as far as I was concerned. But on those sides, that's where I would get the venom, and to get the venom from other wives who are going through the same that you've been through, I just found was really shocking, because they would say, you were too weak, you didn't love him enough, he deserves He deserves somebody better than you. You wouldn't leave him if he lost an arm and a leg. You wouldn't leave him if he lost cancer. And I just think, well, I think he'll find I would, because if someone's going to abuse me, there is no excuse. There is no excuse. PTSD is an explanation. It's not an excuse for that.
Well, it almost seems like the way that the Army would treat him, now the wives are treating you that way.
It absolutely, honestly felt like that. And the page that you mentioned earlier, I mean, that, to be honest, was the first page or group that I actually could say, do you know what, you actually don't have to put up with this. Just because he's a hero and he's a warrior, you actually don't have to put up with this, because you didn't ask for it either. But it was the first time I was actually able to say that publicly and not actually be vilified for it. So there was, whilst a lot of sites I just absolutely left. But that was the first where I was able to actually speak openly and have women who were still there saying, I wish I had your strength. So it's the first time that someone didn't call me weak and actually said, I wish I had your strength to let go of it. Because the other thing with PTSD, I know I describe it as it's Jekyll and Hyde. Because what you do with it, you'll see glimpses of the old person, and it just makes you think there's a chance he's going to come back. But then Mr. Hyde just comes biting. And slowly you see less and less and less of the old person, until it just gets to a point where you just say, enough's enough now. I can't do this anymore.
Right, because, kind of referring back to what I was talking to at the very beginning, there is no justification or reason that anyone should be subject to and endure abuse because someone else is suffering from an illness or a mental illness. I mean, it's still up to them, and they still have to take responsibility and get help. And I think when you just said that, I think to myself, okay, well, if he had willingly admitted this is what I have and I'm going to pursue help 1,000%, and he went through a period where, yes, it was abusive, but he was still trying, he was still seeking help, maybe then it would be justifiable to go, wow, you didn't really give him a chance, but he wasn't interested in that.
No, he wasn't. And I think, there was an instance where I ended up in hospital. I had a black eye, I had a split lip, I had x-rays to see if my cheekbone had been smashed. That, and even that, he was hallucinating at the time, so he didn't feel like he hadn't hit me. If you'd said that to him now, that he'd done that, and you showed him the pictures, he would say he never did that, because it wasn't my face that he saw. But even that, because I researched PTSD and that, so I do understand it, and I get that, I understand that, but it doesn't make it all right, and he couldn't continue to do that. He needed to get help so he didn't do it again. And that's where you get a situation that it's very unsafe for us to actually be around them. No matter how much we love them, no matter how much we're desperate for them to get help, you cannot put yourself in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you can't make someone get help who doesn't want to help themselves.
No. You can't. You cannot save those that don't want to be saved.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit. We have about 5 or 6 more minutes.
Yeah.
Tell me, first of all, does he know that you've written the book?
He does. I did have to let him know, because our local paper was going to run the story, but they didn't in the end, for the reason that, they didn't want to seem critical or didn't want to publish a non-successful story. So he does know about it. I mean, like I said, we don't really have any contact with him, but I had to get in touch with him to let him know. And it was just a mouthful of abuse, to be honest. But annoyed that he thought that I told his story. Because obviously he won't. I doubt very much he's ever read the book, and I think anyone who reads it knows it's not his story; it's my story. So yeah, he knows it's there, and his family have read it and have contacted a family member and said they actually do accept it now, that it was the truth.
Really, that's good.
It's good
as it can be.
Yeah, it's good that they accept it's the truth, but then they still don't do anything about it with him. They still don't make him get help, so they accept that all these things happened and that clearly he was ill, but they don't make him deal with it. He doesn't see his children because he's not really safe to be around them. If he got some help, they would love to see him, but he doesn't and his family don't make him.
What is the treatment for PTSD, and what can people do?
Well, it's not something that I think can go away, but because they've got to deal with that, they basically just got to deal with that traumatic event. So like I was saying, where I blocked out all my happy memories of my marriage, the way I could get those memories back and deal with it was to face it. I had to face it, and that's mm-hmm. what they do with PTSD. They do have to take them over the events that have taken place, and they have to rationalise it in their heads. And I think I read something, it's a bit like they've got all these files floating about in their head, they've got to open and read, and then they've got to file them away. But because they've just pushed them to the back and they're never going to deal with them, they can never get better. But like, that is the way to deal with PTSD. They literally have got to face up to what's causing the trauma in them, or what they did and what they saw.
And PTSD is, to my listeners, PTSD is referred to as an anxiety disorder. I definitely can be quoted on this, but I've had individuals on the show before who suffer with borderline personality disorder, and they've often been linked as well. I'm not saying that PTSD is a personality disorder. However, borderline can be trauma-based, and symptoms can come after a trauma. Just from my knowledge, anxiety disorders and BPD can be absolutely treated, and people can live successfully and healthy and happy lives with those disorders. Now, I want to point out, before you tell my listeners where you can get your book, if they want to order it and read it, and I highly suggest it. Catherine's book is, she mentioned that the paper didn't want to run the story. They didn't want to publish a non-success story, which just makes my blood boil. Because think about all the, so many people who suffer with mental illness and end up committing suicide, or they lose loved ones, or their life doesn't turn out the way they want it to be. Now, these are realities. There may not be successes, but this is what's happening all over. And so it just frustrates me, but I won't go off on a tangent because we don't have very long. But I would like to mention that Catherine's book is not a book that is out to bash her husband. At all. I felt like the book it paints a picture of the reality of what's going on and separates him from the disorder. Now, obviously, if you read it, you feel a little bit intertwined, like all of a sudden the husband has turned into this monster, but she writes it in a way that's sensitive enough to where you understand why it's happening. And so don't confuse that with thinking that it's going to be this book that is going to be about, oh, this is what happened and her husband turned into a total jerk. That's not how it's written. It makes you feel a lot of empathy for him as well as Catherine. So thank you for writing it the way that you did. And it's entertaining, and I don't want to say that in a way of like a happy entertaining, but meaning that it really held my attention to where I just wanted to know what was happening, as well as informative and educational. So thank you.
I mean, that is one of the great bits of feedback that I've had on the book, is that people have so much sympathy for him. They don't feel like thinking, what a jerk, as you say. They just feel so much empathy for him. And I think that is what I wanted from it as well. Well, but can I just come back to, sorry, you mentioned about, when people are committing suicide. I mean, one of the things I know full well of the number 22 in the US, that 22 veterans commit suicide every day. Well, certainly on the group that I have, there are wives who are so broken by this, they just want to end it. They don't want to go on. And that is just from seeing this man that they love just totally destroy them. And there was just nothing that they can do about it. And that is just heartbreaking.
That is heartbreaking. They feel trapped too.
Trapped. Just think they'd just be better off dead, basically. Because as I said, I think in the US what I find really hard is that they have nowhere to go. They have nowhere to turn. The wives are so intrinsically linked to their husbands in the US. Mm-hmm. Not like that in the UK. We have a really good benefit system, and then lots of things that we can call on as independent wives. But I think the wives in the US are just so linked to these men that if they aren't playing ball, they're just like, they feel like second class citizens to me. That, some women, they're living in shelters, they can't put food on the table, they can't leave the state because the courts are sympathetic to the husbands because they're heroes, because they're warriors, irrespective of what they've done behind closed doors.
Right. Well, we do need to wrap up. Can you, two things really quickly, please tell us where it is that we can purchase your book, and also if you just want to leave us with a thought on what it is that we can do as individuals to help end the silence, Catherine.
Well, the book, the paperback of the book, you can only get on Amazon, but you can download it on Kindle as well, and it's also available electronically on Barnes & Noble and iTunes, Kobo, Nook, pretty much all the usual formats. Mm-hmm. And I think the thought that I'd want to say, one of the things I'm working on now with the ladies in my group is we're pulling a video together, and it's just a very stark, just words, it's just our words, and there's so many stories on there. And once I hopefully finish that, if I can let you have that, if you would post that on your site and just ask people, just watch it and just send it on, because you'll
absolutely
see. You'll see.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to thank you. We are going to have to wrap up. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Catherine, and thank you for being a voice for people who are too afraid to stand up. Thank you for everything that you're doing.
And thank you for listening, Chrissy, because like I said, no one would listen to me at the time, and the fact that people are listening now, it just kind of makes my pain not in vain.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're doing great things, and I hope to collaborate with you again in the future. And to any of my listeners, if you have questions for Catherine, you can email me at ocd.chrissie@gmail.com. I'll make sure to pass them on to her. Thank you for joining us from England, Catherine. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Chrissy. Bye-bye.
And thank you to my listeners. If you are interested in being a listener support, please visit my Patreon site to pledge as low as a dollar or more per show. That's patreon.com/thestigmaofmentalillnessradio. This show is helping to make a positive difference in mental illness and ending the stigma. You have been listening to The Stigma of Mental Illness Radio here at cosmicbroadcasting.com. I'm Chrissy Hodges, and we're changing the way we view mental illness, one personal story at a time. Does that make me crazy?